Everyone, you're listening to the Diecast, the world's one and only podcast where you can listen to us talk about irrelevant things and pretty much not do anything constructive. With me is, as always, Seamus.
Hi there.
Rutskarn.
Yeah, I guess.
And Chris, andor Campster.
Hello.
So today we have a very special episode for you because we don't have very much to talk about. So we're gonna go in.
That is the most gripping possible beginning you can get to a podcast on the internet.
We don't normally have much important to talk about, but you know, now we just don't have anything important to talk about. So we're gonna talk a little bit about what we've been doing today, and then we're just gonna go into a bunch of mailbag questions that have been piling up for forever.
Yes, we will reveal where the bodies are buried, who took what drugs in what hotel rooms at what time, what is Mumble's favorite color.
Let's go ahead and start off with Campster. What have you been playing?
Same as last week, quite frankly. I have not yet beaten Rogue Legacy, and that continues to eat gnaw at my bones. Animal Crossing, I'm just sort of in that upkeep mode where I'm not really addicted to it, but I just play it a little every day.
I'm not addicted. I can quit anytime I want.
Let me see if there's anything Steam said real quick. Recently played. Oh, Civ. I guess I've been playing Gods and Kings, Brave New World. That I've also been doing that, and that's I guess kind of new. But as I was telling Josh on Steam chat, I need to stop playing on Chieftain because I'm basically the world leader in science, military, money, and everything else, and I'm not even really trying, and it's kind of insulting that I'm not. I'm not the chair of the World Congress, and I want to be, and I'm not, even though I'm the best guy in the world, and it makes me upset.
Well, you should probably jump the difficulty right up to, like, deity. That's a pretty easy jump from chieftain.
No. I'm going to move it up, like, a notch or two. I did it at this level because I'm trying to get a feel for the expansion's new stuff, which is... This is interesting. There's certainly more to the game than there was before.
So, the last Civilization game I played was Civilization 3, and can I just say that it really cheeses me off when that kind of strategy game gives you a score at the end about, like, how well you did. Like, I mean, you're just going to take an example like Masters of Magic. Like, I win a game of Masters of Magic, and it's like, oh, you got a poor score. I'm like, okay, motherfucker, I've researched all the spells... And I've eliminated all of the other wizards that there are. There are no more wizards! I'm the last one. I have a monopoly on being a wizard in this world. Like, we're not playing fucking skee-ball here. I won.
Does Civ 5 still do that?
Yes. All of the Civ games ever have assigned a score to you. I mean, there's always score victory.
Score is a good way to improve. Like, if you want to judge your performance, like, how fast did I beat them? How efficiently did I beat them? It's sort of an alternative to cranking up the difficulty until you start losing, which is probably what I should do, is you look at the score and say, I didn't do as well this time. I think that strategy of forgetting to build or forgetting to expand didn't work out for me, and maybe I should not do that next time.
I was talking more about... I realize that Civ 5 has a score system. Every Civ has had a score system. I was speaking more about the end game after you win or lose, getting your little results paper summary that compares you to, like, everyone from Alexander the Great and Abe Lincoln down to, like, Jimmy the Sad Face. Yeah, you're Dan Quayle. You're the worst person ever. And I don't know if that's
weird.
Still in the game. Like, I remember being in Civ 4, and in Civ 3, it is still in the game. I haven't beaten the... Civ 5 game and since like the last expansion came out, so I don't remember.
I never know what to make of that. I'm like, it's always like, well, you're a Henry Kissinger, and I'm like, is that middle? Is that bad? I don't know what to
Well, they show you
that.
On a graph.
See, Civ 3, you would just be like, you know, okay, you eliminated all of the other factions, you researched every technology, like you were a kingpin of economy. History remember you as John the Puny, John the Pathetic, something like that. I'm just like, come on. History will remember me as the guy who's still in charge of everybody.
So, okay, aside from the score, though, how is the rest of the expansion pack?
I like it. I archaeology is pretty interesting. I mean, we could have an entire discussion about how the game frames archaeology in and of itself and the changes to culture, because culture used to be an inherently aggressive thing, and they've completely flipped it around such that culture is now an inherently defensive thing, and tourism is your offense, essentially, in a culture victory, and they basically play your previous great wonders and your great artistic works, especially if you can plunder artistic works from other civilizations against, you know, other civilizations' inherent culture, and it's really kind of neat, and we could talk a lot about it, and I don't want to bore everybody with it, but really, the weakest part, I think, is the Brave New World part of Brave New World, which is like, choose one of three ideologies, freedom, and I think it's like autocracy and something else. Do you know what they are?
It's freedom, autocracy, and order, a.k.a. fascism, capitalism, and communism.
But you basically get the, you start getting them in the modern era. Or after you build three factories.
Yeah, you build three factories or get to the modern era.
And basically all they are is an attempt to extend the social victory forward to an endgame thing. Like, social victory, I guess, they felt was a little weak because the original social victory in Civ 5 was fill up five social trees in their entirety. Now I think social victory is what? Filling
well,
up your entire
what it was,
freedom
was...
tree or whatever?
There's actually, they don't actually have a victory type associated with them specifically anymore. In Vanilla and Gods and Kings Civ 5, you could win a cultural victory by filling up five social policy trees, and then you would build this generic utopia project. And if you finished that before anyone else finished one of their victory things, you'd win.
And that I guess, isn't
that
there
was
anymore.
Pretty... dumb. No, that's not there anymore. Also, the diplomatic victory was kind of the same way. You'd get to the right tech to build the United Nations, and then you'd build the United Nations and buy up all the city-states so they'd vote.
Actually, that's the other thing I'm really enjoying here in the late game, is the World Congress is actually really, really good. I really like the changes to the World Congress. It makes city-states important, especially in the endgame, and maintaining a good relationship with city-states is important, and it also makes diplomacy actually really interesting, because now people can just fight against, vote against you out of spite, or vote for you because you're friends, and it makes diplomacy... It doesn't make diplomacy with individual civs any deeper. It's still kind of really shallow in that respect. But because there's this sort of metagame of gaming votes against one another to serve your needs on the world stage, there's sort of that metagame that frames those really shallow diplomatic relations in a way that is interesting and is worthwhile. So I do like that, too. That's pretty good. It's really just the freedom, autocracy, order stuff that I don't care for.
Yeah, and those are just basically like expanded social policy trees, and a lot of the policies in them aren't even that fantastic.
No, they remind me of those stupid Mass Effect style weapon upgrades. It's like either something that's so obscure that you have to be in a very specific situation for it to take advantage of it, or it's something that is, you know, plus one gold from this building you own two of. Well, gee, I'm glad I waited 10 turns for that.
Yeah, I mean, some of the Tier 3 policies are pretty cool. Like you can build entire strategies around them, like, say, the Freedom one that allows you to buy spaceship parts for gold, so you can just, like, very rapidly complete a science victory. Yeah, so that was 10 minutes of Civ 5. Retskarn, what are you doing?
I'm going to be much briefer. I've been writing about 3,000 words a day. I've been writing for the game I'm working on. I've been playing Sleeping Dogs, and it's pretty good. And I'm not going to go into more detail because I don't want to go into. I'll end up talking for about 20 minutes. Watch Chris's video. It's good. Campster's Sleeping Dogs video on YouTube.
I'll link it in the show notes.
I agree with most of that. And finally, I'm looking for a job. I've been trying to get people to pay me money to do things.
What kind of things?
Well, I mean, my specialties are English. I mean, you know, I've been applying to technical writing and social media management jobs. The former mostly requires a decent amount of experience. The latter is, you know, kind of a dodgy field at times, but, you know, it's something I'm good at. And, yeah, that's just, to be honest, most of my time has been divided between those things. I'm also willing to take anything I seem qualified for, but, you know, it's tricky.
Out of curiosity, what things do you seem to be qualified for? Like, that you were finding?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, like, you know, my qualifications as far as degree and experience go mostly have to do with, you know, I have some management stuff, but nothing in a professional context. You know, I have the Kickstarter I managed. And as far as actually doing things go, it's pretty much exclusively putting words together on a page, on an internet document. Like, I might be able to do something else, but I don't have anything, any documentation to that effect. I don't have any recorded history of me doing
that.
Yeah,
that's always the problem with trying to get a job. Yeah. Usually the requirements are way higher than any entry-level person can actually manage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've sent out some mildly promising applications. You know, when I say promising applications, I mean, like, you know, it's possible that somebody might see their way to hiring me for this, but, you know, it's going to be a long haul. I'm keeping other irons in the fire while I'm working on that.
Well, we wish you luck. Seamus, what video games have you been video gaming?
I've been playing Titan Attacks and Ultratron, which are two retro... They're basically 80s remix games. They're both from the same developer, Puppy Games, which I think is like a super small operation. It's like 1 to 3 people. And one's a Titan Attacks is a Space Invaders remix, and Ultratron is a Robotron remix. And I've been digging them a whole lot. But I'm just playing them. They're very much lightweight games. You play them 10 minutes at a stretch when you're taking a break from the other thing I'm doing, which is writing tons and tons of code. And I might actually turn that into a post-series. We will see.
Right, right. I wasn't going to push you too much on what the parameters of that are.
Yeah, and I'm not even... Well, the thing about writing about my coding is I don't want to be like, okay, I'm doing a new series on a new programming series, because, you know, those things run about 10 to 20 entries and get everybody all excited, oh boy, because I know this is like one of the favorite things that I do, that people just love my programming series, and I don't want to like have this great big fanfare, do week one, here's what I accomplished, and then come back in week two and said, you know what, I'm bored with this, I'm done. And have it end after one entry. So I kind of like want to make sure that I'm going, that this is going to go somewhere worth talking about before I pour words and time and get everybody excited for it. So that's what I'm doing.
All right. Hey, Josh, what have you been playing? Thank you for asking, Josh. I've been playing Metro Last Light. And wow. It's. It's a Metro game. It's weird, actually. I got it when it was on sale, as I mentioned. And I also decided to pick up the Ranger pack, even though I kind of abhor the bullshit of pay money to get difficulty levels. So I wanted to see what was going on there. If only to warn people away from it. I mentioned that I played Metro 2033 in Ranger mode on the Ranger difficulties, which are harder ostensibly anyway. But everything kills you in like one shot, and you kill everything in one shot. So it's kind of a trade-off. And the thing that I'm noticing with Metro Last Light is they made everything way easier. Like Metro 2033 had a pretty in-depth stealth system, where like you had like four distinct phases or stages of visibility. Like totally lit up, somewhat lit up, not very much lit up, and then just totally not lit up, like totally dark, totally invisible, basically. And this game only has two, and it's visible and not visible. So you have this weirdness where you can just sit in a dark corner and be totally invisible to the dudes that are walking by you with headlamps on because you just happen to not be catching quite enough light. And they also took out all of the sound-based stealth, whereas in the first game there would be like glass shards on the floor or cans hanging to like alert people when you knocked into them, and people would freak out and get up and like go like, "What the fuck? Ah, somebody's triggering the alarms." But in this game there's none of that, so you can just basically run around and stealth entire sections with impunity. And there's also a lot more ammo. But the weirdest thing I've noticed about Ranger mode is that they went like full like almost no HUD. But in the process of doing that, they made it so you can't check how much ammo you have ever. You don't see how much ammo you pick up. You don't see how much ammo you have left in your guns. You can't check your inventory to see how much ammo you have left, except for the military-grade rounds, which are the ammo that's also currency. Like, there's no point, aside from going back to town and going to a shop where you can actually see how many fucking machine gun rounds you have. And it's weird as fuck.
Well, that's realistic, though. I mean, you're not
I
going to be
know
able to
it
look down
isn't.
and go,
I mean,
"I have 473 machine gun bullets left."
But there's plenty of downtime where you'd think you could, like, take your backpack off and look through it and see, like, "Okay, I've got
you should at least know
this
how
many
many
rounds."
You should at least
you
know
should
how
at
many
least
magazines
know.
You've got.
Yeah, you should at least know approximately, like, am I about to run out or am I carrying 8 pounds of them? I think you would know that.
I mean, in Metro 2033, you could see how many rounds you picked up and how many rounds you had left. But in this game, you don't have either of those indicators. And there's even, like, a special inventory screen where you can see the stuff in your inventory, but the sections that you normally have where you can see how much ammo you have for each gun are removed. It's so freaking weird. I don't understand why they would do that.
Because you're a ranger, and you keep all the gun bullet numbers in your head, because you're a ranger.
It's not that important, because
one, two,
there's
three,
way
five,
more ammunition.
Six, seven, eight, 9, 10, 12.
Well, the other problem is you can't see how many in each, like cache of ammo, how many bullets you're actually getting. And they're not reflected by, like the physical appearance of it. Like, you can pick up a whole magazine of, like, machine gun rounds, and it only has one bullet in it, or at least that you could in Metro 2033. So you don't... You can't tell how much you have until you discover that you can't pick up any more of a certain ammo type because you've hit the cap. So that... It's annoying. I mean, it hasn't ruined me yet. Like, I haven't run into a point where I'm like, "Oh, shit, I'm totally out of ammo, and I had no idea." But
it sounds annoying, but it also sounds like I think that might be intentional in trying to up the tension, because you don't know how much ammo you have left, and therefore rounding that corner and trying to figure out if you want to take a guy out becomes all the more tense, because not only is it kill or be killed almost instantly, but, you know, those bullets, you don't know how much of them you're going to be spending of a total amount.
Except you could just round that corner and magically kill the dude by throwing your super magic throwing knife that murders everyone in one hit when they hit them in the hand.
Okay,
or
that's kinda
or just sneak up to him and punch him in the face. It's a lot easier to deal with enemies, and ammo is more it doesn't feel hard anymore. which I don't know, maybe that's good. I don't like it as much, but aside from that, the game is pretty good though. It's very clearly written by the same people. But I think we've held up the mailbag for long enough, so let's get to it.
We've got a lot of mail to bag.
Arthur Caldazar says, "Dear Diecast, what is your opinion of game design colleges and other institutions that teach programming, art, and so on with reference to making video games?"
Well, most of them apparently are scams.
I would here's the thing. Right now we are having a complete glut of degrees. People are coming. I mean, this is just in general. I mean, this is like people with long standing. This used to be an awesome degree to get. Rutzgarn, case in point. Rutzgarn, smart guy, reliable. If I was running a thing, I'd hire Rutzgarn in a heartbeat. But now there's nothing to set him apart. If I'm looking at the resumes, I can't tell the difference between a Rutzgarn and somebody else because everybody has a degree. So that's within this already degree glut that we've got going on, we've got a incredible glut of people that want to go into video games because, hey, that's fun work, right? I love video games. I'll make video games when I grow up. So we've got all these young people going into video gaming. And so you're going to pay all this money to get a greatly devalued degree in an incredibly oversaturated market. You are really, really playing with fire. I'm not saying you won't get a job, but the number of people that will waste money on that degree are going to vastly outnumber.
And the other issue is, these are not even real degrees, are they? I mean, this is more like a trade school kind of thing. You don't go to like Full Sail and get a bachelor's in video game programming. You go and get like a certification that says you completed the Full Sail course on video game programming or something to that extent. Which, I mean, is respected within the video game industry, but outside of that, that's basically nothing.
Well, there's two sides to that. Side number one is, and the extra credits episode on this is actually pretty good if you want to watch that, but it taps into the same thing, which is a lot of these schools are really fly-by-night money pits. A few of them, like Full Sail, really are good at landing people jobs, but just because, you know, Full Sail and one or two other, you know, trade schools are good at landing people jobs doesn't mean all of them are, and you have to be very, very careful with saying, oh, it's a video game school, therefore it is going to get me a video game job. Not all of them will. Full Sail and a few others are supposedly pretty good at landing people jobs because their programs are so rigorous and they have the connections, but not all of them are. And on top of that, you really are putting all of your eggs in one basket when you do this. You don't have a fallback plan, which is the other scary thing. Like I have a general computer science degree. I can go program anywhere. I can specialize in stuff that's video game related. I haven't, but I could have if I wanted to, and gotten a job as a programmer at a video game company, and then if that fell through, I could do any other number of things. A general, like going to a general software company with a degree from Full Sail that says you know how to make 3D rendering technology is not going to look real great to a web startup or a big IBM company that doesn't need that skill set.
The other thing I'll say about this is that how long are these schools? 2 years? 4 years? However that long they are.
They're 2 or 3 years.
However long they are, just imagine if you sit at home and just teach yourself everything you can get your hands on. Just drink up and make as much stuff as you can. Just make a game, and when the idea's played out, make another one. And some of it'll be crappy, it'll get better over time. Imagine how much you could accomplish in 2 years. You might have a shippable game in 2 years instead of being 2 years in debt with nothing to show for it. And if you're out there trying to actually produce things with the tools that are available now, you will have skills that are relevant now. There's a problem that schools have where, okay, a new technology comes along, you need somebody to learn it, then you need them to stop doing it so that they can become a teacher, then they need to distill it into curriculum, and then they need to teach it to you. It's been years by the time it's being taught in a classroom. And this industry moves really, really fast, and the tools are it's stable. It's getting more stable now. This is becoming less true, but you know, these tools age quickly. So rather than learning technology from 4 years ago for huge amounts of money, and being taught a little of everything, stay at home. And spend those 2 years really focusing. And if you're like, well, I don't know, what should I study and what should I do? Then I would say, this is probably not the industry for you. I mean, if you're not already chomping at the bit, like, I really want to do this, you just want to work on video games because you like video games. That would be my advice to somebody.
And really,
there's no guarantee that enjoying a thing will mean you enjoy making it. I like hot dogs.
That's the other thing.
I don't want to work at a hot dog factory.
Is you may think you want to work in the AAA game industry, but you don't. You probably do not actually want to. I mean, unless you enjoy working 60 to 80 hour weeks for 12 months at a time, you probably don't actually want to work in the AAA game industry.
You think that sounds awesome when you're 18 and you don't need to sleep and you can eat anything and you never feel sick and you're just like so energetic. When you're 25 and you've got somebody that you want to marry, or maybe you've got a kid now, suddenly that really romantic hardcore of like, I'm going to work for 16 hours, fall asleep for 6, wake back up, slam back some coffee, and get right back to coding. That's romantic when you're 21, and it's absolutely soul-sucking misery when you're 25, and it will just make you hate your life. And, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to carry on that thought, which is basically these trade schools are designed to exploit that. Even things like Full Sail, generally speaking, you're not getting guys that at least not yet, you're not getting guys that graduate from Full Sail and end up being, you know, captain game designer, lead creative director, or creative lead of any major titles. Maybe in 10, 20 years, but right now, really what you're seeing is that people take these jobs, or take these degrees and these certifications, and end up with, I'm the guy that did the tree textures on the video games until I got burnt out and quit and was replaced by, you know, 3 more kids from my alma mater. You're not talking about
speed
like a
tree 5.0.
Yeah. So even the ones that get jobs don't necessarily keep these jobs. That's a really good point. They're like, oh, so what? I saw a statistic. They're like, you know, 60% of our graduates find jobs in the industry within a year. And I'm like, 60? That's horrible. If I told you, hey, slam down $200,000 and you've got a 60% chance of a payout on that bet. The payout is going to be a steady job for $50,000 a year as long as you can stand it. That is about the most monumentally horrible bet you could take. Especially since after you pay the money, you've still got to pay time. And yeah, so you're paying money to get a degree so you can work in an industry with low pay and notoriously horrible hours that most people leave very quickly. I would not take that bet. I realize it sucks if you want to make games. Right now, there are more people that want to make games than there are jobs for, and probably I would not be surprised by like 5-1, 10-1. I mean, those are just, the odds are so absolutely abysmal. The only place that has worse odds is people who want to go into acting. Imagine if somebody is like, is it worth me getting a degree in theater so that I can go and try and become a movie star? You know, that pays off for a small number of Ian McKellens, and it tragically backfires and ends up horribly for a staggering number of waiters and busboys.
The good news is you don't actually have to have a degree or go to school to make video games. You can just make video games.
Yeah,
so if you're really set on doing video games as a career, you should probably get into indie game creation. Come up with an idea and see what you can do with it. At the very least, while you're working on it, you won't be wasting a bunch of time going to school that you might not even decide that you want to go to and finish after a while.
Right. Your risk when you make an indie game is the time you put into it. Your risk in getting the degree, your risk going the other way is the time you spend getting the degree, the money you spend getting the degree, the time you put into it, and the toll it takes on your life. So indie gaming is incredibly dangerous, but I still think it's much, much safer than going the mainstream route.
Yeah, the bottom line is, okay, so if you want to make video games, here's what you do. You learn to do something, or you get a regular job, you go down a regular career path, get paid regular money, sustain yourself, and in your off hours you make a video game.
Yep.
And, you know, if you find yourself after a few months going, well, this sucks, I should have just gone to the school, I end up coming home and working until like 4 in the morning and I don't have time for anything else or anyone else, and I'm just making this fucking game and I'm sick of it, I don't know what I'm doing. Well, that's pretty much what a job at video games is like, often enough. So
yeah, you could always go to the school if you think you need it, but when it comes to video gaming, the tools are out there. Everything you need is out there to find. Maybe not everything, but enough to get you in the door. If you can't make a game with the tools that aren't out there, then your lack of tools is not your problem. There are tools to make games at every conceivable level. If you don't know a lot of programming and you just want to do scripting and writing, there's tools for that. If you're more like me and you've got a more technical background, there's tools for that. There are tool sets for whatever your skill level and whatever it is you want to do. So you do not need the school to learn what you need to know to make a game.
That said, after we've ragged on these schools for, you know, 10 minutes, if you go into these schools knowing what you're going to ultimately get out of it, not to defend these schools because they do cause a lot of pain, but if you recognize the fact that you're going to be spending a lot of money that you might never recoup, and you recognize the fact that you're going to be getting an entry-level job in an industry that you might find completely ruins your life and you hate it in 5 years and completely want out, if you can reconcile those concepts, maybe it's worth your money? But you have to be able to recognize those risks, that you're paying someone else for a lot of money for what is not a sure ticket into an entry-level job of an industry designed to grind up 20-somethings with more energy and passion than common sense and forward-looking desire to have a sustainable life. And if you can acknowledge that, I don't know, now that I say that out loud, I guess I kind of don't really think you should do it. But, you know.
Yeah, you know what? Fuck video games!
Really, this is a I love video games, but I hate what people have to go through to get them made. It's a lot of effort.
The thing is, it's Seamus made an analogy to a art school acting degree earlier, and it's not quite analogous, I think, because at least if you get a real communications or art degree or a acting degree or whatever, I guess it's communications, I don't know, I didn't go to a liberal arts college, but if you get one of those, there's still local theaters, there's still places you can apply to that actually take that.
Yeah.
If you don't get in with EA or Activision or Ubisoft or one of three other publishers, no one else is going to take you. I mean, that sounds really harsh, but the reality is the smaller studios want experience, or they want people that don't have the baggage of $20,000 or $50,000 or whatever of student loan debt hanging over their heads because they're, you know, a small startup that can't pay you enough to, you know, compensate you for that. So I don't want to poo-poo these colleges too much, because there are people out there that go there and they really want to program video games and they learn how to program 3D engines and they didn't know that before, and it's $50,000 cheaper than I don't want to say a quote-unquote real college degree, but it's cheaper than going to the local state college or whatever. And they come out and they get a job at EA and they couldn't be happier, and life goes on and they're happy. And you might be one of those people, but I have to stress the number of people that come out of that system like that is very small. Very, very, very... Even the people that land jobs end up leaving the industry after like 5 or 10 years. So the number of people that are really genuinely happy and just stick around forever is just so small. You have to, like, love 3D programming or love making the texture model of a dude's butt or whatever it is that you're going to be doing. You have to already know.
Like, a dude's butt is actually pretty generous when you think about it. Because, like, you know, you think about, like, oh, I'm doing modeling for a game. You think of yourself, like, drawing a werewolf or some shit. Like, okay, so next time you play Skyrim, and, like, you're going through the werewolf thing, look around a room and count how many objects in the room are werewolves. And how many of them have
sex. The guy that makes all the burial urns.
And you notice that there's one werewolf model, and there's, like, four kinds of bucket in the room. And ask yourself, I just came out of college, am I a werewolf guy? Or am I bucket guy?
You know, that's kind of unfair, though, because you might end up on the Fallout 3 team and make tin cans. So I don't want to just imply that you'll only make buckets. There's a lot of things. You might end up in New Vegas and, you know, you'll make bottles of sarsaparilla. So really, the sky's the limit here.
But, I mean, you guys bring up a valid point. Like you're not going to be the guy that's John Carmack, and you're not going to be the guy that comes up with a brilliant art design lead, not for your first 5, 10 years in the industry. You're going to be the guy that does sarsaparilla bottles, and the guy, like, you go in for a design position, and you think, oh, a design position, that's going to be real high up. I'm going to be a designer. They're going to give you gooey stuff. They're going to give you, okay, design the tutorial, smart guy. You know, that's what you're going to get.
Right, and people that really have this urge to make games, you probably have something that you want to do. Like, oh, I'd love to make a game that has a system that works like this, or I really love this kind of game, and I'd love to design a system that works this way. And you will not get to do that, or at least you're not going to get to do that for more than a decade. Even if you're an ace, even if the degree was free, that would be a very slow way to reach that goal. Again, if you just want to design systems, indie's probably the way to go. And yeah, it's not a good... You will not make a living making indie games. You will supplement decent income. Unless you're one of the few superstars. You know, your John Blows, your Phil Fish. Those guys probably make a living at it, but for the vast majority of them, they make pretty good part-time job money. And so they use game making as a part-time job, and they've got a real job to back it up. And that's probably where you should look.
Well, I hope that answers your question, Arthur.
Let's cap it at an hour, guys, but let's also spend an hour on the first fucking question.
That's a good question. This is something I love that they asked that question. I've been itching to talk about that for months.
All right. Let's go for another one here. Dear Diecast, playing through a bunch of recent-ish titles, it struck me that there is a heck of a lot of ruins in video games, especially fantasy-themed ones, and a lot of emphasis on glory's past and how things used to be so much more awesome than these days. What is the reason for it? It just seems so backwards to me. Hope you can continue this podcast for years to come. Yours with respect, Ira. P.S. If there's time, Mr. Young, could you comment on what you like most about Spider-Man? These do not seem to be related questions. Well, with the first one, I can say that this actually has a pretty strong basis in history. It's important to remember that the civilizations that we think of as ancient are themselves built upon far more ancient civilizations. For example, the Greeks had this whole idea about the different ages of the world, and in each age things got a little bit worse. And they were well aware of far more ancient Greeks that had lived in the Peloponnese and Ionia, and they were aware of these cultures that existed long before them. I mean, the Assyrians and the Babylonians built great museums full of artifacts from cultures that were thousands of years older than them. It's important to realize that, like, the world did not start with Rome or Greece or Persia. There were thousands of years of history before that, and thousands of years of prehistory before even the first history that we have from the Sumerians and Egyptians. And a lot this was a thing that a lot of people thought about in the ancient world is about how, well, there were ancient people to them too.
Yeah. Right, like when Cleopatra looked out at the pyramids, she was like, "Yeah, those are those fucking old pyramids that have been around as long as anyone can remember." Like for
Right.
them, those were historical structures. Like history is something that has existed for a long time. That seems like a really weird thing to say. History has existed for a long time. I actually seriously recommend to anyone who's not to begin a study of ancient history, and I don't mean like the Greeks. I mean, like, go back to the first point where they found a hand axe near a human bone. And then go back past that to the first point where they found something that looks like a human bone. And sort of let it settle over you how much we fixate on the last 2,000 years of shit happening to human beings in the grand scheme of things, and how many cities we've built, and how many civilizations we've had, and how much bullshit we've done that. Before today's cities and bullshit.
But really, I think the reason is that ruins A have no NPCs. You don't have to worry about it being a real city. B, ruins are usually pretty empty, so you don't have to worry about filling it with, you put in some pots, maybe a few caskets. Hey, ruins! It's not like a modern street corner. They're
It
also
doesn't
they
need to
also
be.
tend to be pretty open. Like there's area for combat. Like not unlike a dorm room or something where you got 4 feet on each side.
I don't know
Yeah,
about you,
you don't
Caster.
need.
I keep having to fight Draugr in all the ruin.
I mean, if okay, let's say why don't we have the play space take place in a city? Okay, cities are filled with NPCs if there's no NPCs or well, this is why people also love the zombie apocalypse. Get rid of all the NPCs. How come when I do this, the NPCs don't react? How come when I do this, the NPCs don't react? Okay, well, let's create a game world with no bystanders, where there's only your enemies and the people you directly interact with, other, deliberately designed characters. And if we were setting it in a city, well, we know what a city looks like. And if you get something wrong, hey, streets don't end at a dead end like this. They just keep going and going. You can make ruins however you want. Nobody's gonna say, this isn't accurate to how Pompeii was actually laid out. This is completely wrong. And if we do it in the modern world, we know what the inside of a building looks like. It needs to be, houses needs to be filled with furnishing and knickknacks on the shelf and everything that needs to be modeled, where you can have empty rooms in a ruin. And like Chris said, you've got game space, we've got excuses. Also, things can be crumbling, so we can have walls collapse when we want to, we don't want to build a giant city, so we can build a little part of a city and then just have it all crumbled so you can't go any further, so we can wall the player into a given area. Boom. So ruins are just way more convenient for from a game design standpoint.
They're
And
also
anything.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean.
Oh, I just and modern settings are problematic.
I was just going to say that they also have a sense of gravitas. I mean, for all intents and purposes, you could set your video game in a field and solve all these same problems, but a field isn't very dramatic or interesting. It's just sort of an open space. A ruin gives it a sense of you can fill in the backstory with lore. You can introduce this sorts of the sense of gravitas to what's going on. There's a sense of adventure of exploring this long abandoned place. Whereas if you were just in a field or a forest, it's like, oh, there are bad guys behind that tree.
Or a
I
cave.
should hit them. Or in a cave. Yeah, cave too.
Yeah, here's the bottom line. It's like sewers. It's a solution to all these problems that is established, that leaps easily to mind. a dozen other game companies have done it. You've played games that look like that. You've heard of games that look like that. You've designed games that look like that. So if you're coming up with a solution, what's the solution that comes to mind? The same thing people always do. You know, I would encourage you as a thought experiment to think, okay, well, if I have all those problems, where am I going to set my game? And, you know, you could come up with all kinds of answers, you know, like graveyard, Space Hulk. But ultimately, you know, Ruins works just fine.
There's Space Hulk was done with Dead Space.
Yeah. Also,
I don't
Space
think
Hulk.
Of any graveyards, though.
Any like vast? Well, that's kind of a that's kind of a metal concept, like a game world that's just graveyards. I guess.
Like, I guess Diablo.
Diablo, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, just endless graveyard.
Actually, that's kind of like you got if you could like hop in graves and transport like, or if you could go through catacombs, it'd be like if somebody made a game of the Gravedigger series from a Gun Show. Although I guess he actually goes on subway trains and fights giant worm clusters and stuff.
But all the levels could be just synonyms. It would be like, okay, level one is the gravesite, level two is the sepulcher, and then it's the mausoleum.
Okay, now you're talking about Diablo.
So yeah, there's a strong historical precedent for having ruins and having people think about ruins, and they're easy from a game design standpoint. They're also pretty spooky. There's something kind of primordially terrifying about walking through the ruins of what was once a great and powerful civilization.
Yeah. Wow, other people lived out their lives here, common people, and they're gone. It's like the place is haunted.
We could say all kinds of things like arch British accents, like, well, the thing about the ruins is that when you look at a ruin, you remember that your civilization is not permanent. It's a memento mori to the sense of self in a certain gap. But no, I mean, it's mostly because of the reasons we came up with.
Yeah, so I think crypts or ruins, not because we revere the past and we think, wow, the past was so much better. I think it's just, you know, easy shorthand for game space that is easy to design and doesn't need a lot of fidelity and that isn't going to cause a lot of problems from a design standpoint.
Okay, we're on a roll. That one took much less than a half hour.
Hello, Diecast team. I'm interested in your opinion on what I call benign deaths. In most video games, dying means you have to start over from an earlier point in time. Either you respawned at a checkpoint or you reloaded a quick save. But in some games, you respawn into the world without resetting time. For example, Bioshock 1 and 2, you have the Vita Chambers, and Infinite does something similar. In Prey, you are temporarily placed in some kind of netherworld. Rage has the defibrillator mechanic, etc. Now, what I find interesting is the fact that I absolutely hated the Vita Chambers in Bioshock, and other people did as well. After years of death means reloading, this concept just seemed totally wrong and like cheating. Additionally, the idea stretched credibility way too much for me.
There's a big backlash.
On the other hand, I enjoy the corresponding mechanic in Prey and Rage a lot, and I'm okay with it in Bioshock Infinite. What do you think? Why did this mechanic cause so much outrage when it was introduced in Bioshock but not in the other games? Why is it enjoyable in one game and utterly annoying in another? Best regards, Nico.
What had frustrated me about the Vita Chambers is that you could just graveyard rush your way to victory. Okay, you know, the challenge as designed by the game designer is you kill these three splicers in this room where they've got, you know, they surround you. That's the challenge that I want you to overcome. And they surround you, they kill you, and then you respawn in the Vita Chamber. Now you're fighting them through a choke point. Now you're fighting them through the door, and you're not doing that challenge anymore. And you killed one of them, so now you just have to fight two of them, and one of them's injured. So now, instead of getting through the conceptual challenge of fight three splicers when they pounce on you, and, you know, the real way to solve that is, you know, freeze one of them, stun lock the other with electricity, and then gun the other one down, and, you know, you actually have to think about the gameplay. Where, and when I die, I want another shot at that. I want to go back to the point before I got surrounded by the splicers and actually overcome the designed challenge. And instead, now I've just got to mow down mooks flowing through a doorway at me. The intended challenge is gone and replaced with a boring one. So you're being kind of ripped off of the encounter that you were designed for.
It also felt like, to me, in BioShock, some of the challenges were almost sort of designed around the idea that the player wouldn't lose if they died, so they allowed them to be really unfair.
Yeah, from a game design perspective, they don't have to balance it and make sure it's fair. It's like, oh yeah, really, the player really, this is an unreasonable difficulty spike where there's no business being a difficulty spike, but who cares? They just respawn in the Vita Chamber. We don't need to balance our game.
So,
close enough.
So I think there's a deeper issue being discussed here that I don't know if we really need to bring up, but just to... We've talked about this before, I guess, but just to remind everybody who's listening, the real problem with the idea of death in sort of a linear, story-driven first-person game is that it's effectively a mechanic that's a do-it-again-stupid mechanic, because in reality, like, there are other games where losing is a generally accepted actual outcome of the story, a roguelike, for instance, or Dwarf Fortress, or even in some situations, something like Minecraft, or any sort of game with permadeath. Like, those are the outcome. You did your thing, you created your little dwarf community, and then dwarf number 47 mined too deep and opened up a magma chamber accidentally and killed the whole lot of you. Oh no, but that's your story and that's the end of it. In a linear, story-driven, and not necessarily first-person, but generally any sort of linear story-driven game.
That's way less grim than any other death I've had in Dwarf Fortress.
Well, okay, he gets the plague and vomit pukes the plague on every... I don't know, I don't want to make it dark.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, but if you starve to death in Dwarf Fortress, what are you going to do? Reload your save from 5 minutes ago? 5 minutes before everybody starved to death? You're going to grow crops in 5 minutes? You're coming to the conclusion of a long doomed scenario. So yeah, you can't... Saving can't even help you even if it was in there. Or you'd have to go back so far, you might as well just start.
So I mean, really the reason that you have things like Vita Chambers is that in games like Half-Life, death is not really an acceptable outcome the way it is in, say, Dwarf Fortress. Gordon Freeman it's not canonical that Gordon Freeman slips by missing a jump and falls to his death off the bridge. That's in no universe do we ever consider that a canonical ending to Half-Life. So we basically all pretend that that didn't happen, and we hit the quick load key, and we come back, and we do it again. Death is just sort of an oopsie rather than a permanent lose state. And since it's not a real lose state the way it is in, say, Dwarf Fortress, game designers have looked to ways to integrate death as not that sort of stupid, do-it-again-stupid mechanic. They don't want to tap you on the, or slap you on the wrist and go, no, do it again, stupid, because that's... No, we're not benefiting. You know that's not how the story ends. We know that's not how the story ends. It's not a legitimate state for the game to fall into. It's just this sort of arbitrary, do-it-again-stupid moment. So designers do things like the Vita Chambers. I think the reason the Vita Chambers specifically failed, or at least failed to resonate with a lot of people, was that there was little to no cost for the player, and there was no effective lose state. Like, at least in System Shock 2, which used a similar respawn function, you lost nanites, and that hurts you hard, because nanites are the main resource of the game. You buy ammo, you buy food, you buy hypos, you buy various other things with nanites. And so if you lose, you know, 40% of your nanites, or whatever the percentage is, it might be lower than that, but you lose nanites and you feel it. In BioShock, and even in BioShock Infinite, you don't really lose anything by dying.
Also, in System Shock 2, you had to find the respawn chamber, I forget what it was called, that reconstruct you. You had to find it, so it was a reward, and you had to turn it on, or activate it, or imprint your DNA structure onto it, and if you died before you found it on that level, it was game over time. So it was kind of a reward. All right, now you've activated the chain. It was also optional. If you just hated it, I remember having games where I didn't like the idea of coming back, so I just would... In System Shock 1, actually, I just refused to use it. And it was optional. It wasn't like you just... Because I really wanted to... Okay, this encounter, this room, these guys, I don't want to, like, give my life to kill one of them, then give my life to kill another, and then give my life to kill the third one. I want to beat all three of them one way or another, and I don't want to graveyard rush them. And so it was optional, it was a reward, and it actually had a cost to use. The Vita Chamber really took all that away.
It cheapens the experience. When you have no death, it just makes it feel like, well, then what the hell? I mean, I don't have to worry about dying here because I'll just come back. There's no tension.
What? Oh, your punishment is you are teleported a few feet away. Why bother doing that? Why can't I just stand? Why don't I just turn on God mode and just stand in the middle of the room and shoot people?
So I think the things like the Borderlands Last Stand and the Defibrillator in Rage were an attempt to sort of crossbreed those things. Like, the Defibrillator in Rage is interesting because it basically still has the do it again stupid mechanic if you do die, but if you lose all your health, you have a second fighting chance. And same thing with the Borderlands stuff. Although Borderlands, you can keep chaining infinitely as long as there's enough low-level mooks to keep you alive. Either way, though, the idea is you reach zero health, and instead of smacking you with a 2x4 and going, do it again, stupid, and instead of not really doing anything and just teleporting you away at no cost, they have this sort of mid-range, okay, now for serious, you're in danger. Like, now it really matters.
It's a way of giving you negative feedback, okay, you're not playing properly, so that you can correct, oh, I'm being too reckless, or I'm not using my resources properly. It's a way of giving you that feedback that you are not, that you need to change how you're doing it, without immediately dumping you out of the game and saying, haha, reload, or making it feel like it doesn't matter. Those semi-death states are really, really good in any of the games, especially Borderlands. I love that in Borderlands, where you kind of understand that you're failing without failing so hard that you have to stop playing the game.
I actually really like Borderlands also because it does use the Vita Chamber mechanic of, oh, you died, whatever, we're just going to respawn you, you don't have to reload, but you do lose money, and a fairly sizable portion of your money, and much like in System Shock, I think it's balanced to a point where it hurts. Like, you realize that you've lost 2 grand, or 5 grand, or 20 grand, or whatever percentage it is that takes out of your wallet.
That's actually,
you know that.
That's actually not why it hurts in Borderlands 2, though. The reason it hurts in Borderlands 2 to have the death where you die and, like, go back to the beginning and have to redo all the level, in addition to the fact that, you know, your friends are shooting things while you're hustling back, is that you had a chance before that not to die. It's not like you get shot in the head and you instantly teleport to the beginning and you're like, oh, well, that was dumb. You get shot in the head, you go down on your knees, and you have to, like, fight for your life by, like, a new minigame has begun where you have to survive. And failing that minigame grinds it in. It's like, fuck, I really suck. Not only did I lose all my health, but I couldn't even murder anybody before the time elapsed, or I couldn't even get to my friends. That's shitty. I'm shit. I'm going to get better. That's the effect of dying in Borderlands.
It really is well balanced. I like it a lot. And I think that probably is the I don't want to say the quintessential way to approach it, because there's lots of ways to skin this cat, but it is probably the best way I've seen so far, because games like Half-Life, death is inconsequential because you quick load, and games like BioShock, death is inconsequential because you just instantly come back. Here, you're given a second chance. If you still screw up, we will teleport you away, but we will take a sizable portion of your money. You'll feel bad about it, but then you'll learn and carry on, and either know now that you're too low level or that you need a different gun or whatever. But that's actually really instructive and helpful and interesting, and makes death feel like a lose state without stopping the game dead in its tracks, and I think that's kind of cool.
Alright, I think that pretty much wraps it up, and that is our last question of the episode.
Is that all our time?
Yep, we are at exactly an hour.
Well, thank you for writing in, everyone. Remember, you can always write in more questions that we may or may not answer, because we tend to run out of time and spend 30 minutes on each question diecast@seamusyoung.com. Alternatively, you can just, you know, yell at me. That's always nice. It makes me feel like I exist.
Yes. Can I also just say that I like it whenever anybody begins their question with Dear Diecast, because it really does sound like you're about to say, Dear Diary.
It's actually a question about that here that starts with the Dear Diary cast.
That's
funny. I think I've made this comment before on a previous episode. Come think of it.
Okay, bye.
Well, that's the show.
We know when we hit the awkward pause part of the episode.
Let's find a way to finish this episode so we can roll the credits music.